hello and welcome back to AA Opera Podcast episode 94.
Woof woof.
We're getting into the swing of this now. You know, back in season 7, we're into the swing.
And you've all been loving season 7 so far.
Oh my goodness.
Incredible. Thank you so
much. The response. Yeah, the response has been great. You guys are listening and loving. What and more loving. Could we want?
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Abby, how are you doing?
I am so good. I found out who my surprise was.
Yes. We had a few surprises.
One of my best friends came in from Israel for my birthday, which was incredible. Just not expecting that. At around 10:30 p.m. on Thursday night, Matt just goes, "So if someone were to come by now, how would you feel?" I was like, are they staying the night? Like, they're like, he just can't come. They just can't come on Sunday, so they're going to come today. And I was just like, it's 10:30 p.m. Where are they coming from? Like, are they staying? He's like, do you want to put on a bra or something? I'm like, anyone who's coming now is getting me the way I am.
Good for you.
And then my best friend walked through the door. It was incredible. Oh. It was amazing. And he stayed for the weekend. And then another friend of mine, who we all know and love on this podcast, Rachel Liddell, also surprised us and came down from Scotland.
Yeah, that was lovely for me because I got to see Rachel on Sunday too, which was your other surprise.
Yeah.
Which was
my other surprise.
I'll let you tell them, but like I think I ruined it a little bit because when I was going there on Sunday, I saw you guys walk in and I just thought like Abby knows that like something's going on. So I just like went up to you and Matt and I was like, hi. And then you were like, okay, so I'm not going on the tube. And I was like, oh, shit. I was like, I've ruined that.
It was all good. We went to a paint your own pottery place. And everyone was just so calm. And so many lovely people were there. And it was just really nice to just spend the Sunday afternoon painting pottery. I have a new teapot coming that I made.
Yeah.
I'm very excited.
You are a natural at that, by the way. You are an absolute natural. I was sat up opposite Avi, right? She had this teapot. I had this jug. Like, I was just drawing lines on this jug. And Avi was like doing intricate drawings, like anthropology-esque artwork on this teapot and putting my art to shame. I don't even think I can call it art.
I just have to say, I did a lot of art lessons as a kid. Like, that's my outlet. That was like dance and drawing. Like, that's what I did. So I did a lot. But I also feel that the thing that I'm really good at drawing is flowers. So I can't draw much else. But I can draw a still life of flowers.
I could see that.
But it was really wonderful. And it just put me in a really good mood for the rest of the week. What about you, Ashley? How are you?
I'm okay. And I would just like to thank Matt for organizing the painting pottery because I am rather stressed at the moment. But I did say, had I not taken 3 hours out of my Sunday to come and paint, I feel like I would be a lot more stressed than what I am. Like, I needed that time to switch off. And that was the highlight of my week. So thank you. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
You're welcome. I did all the work. I was born.
You were born, yeah. Yeah. But shall we crack on with this week's episode?
Yes, we should definitely crack on with this week's episode. This week we have James Black. He is James Black manager, who we may or may not have dropped his name a couple of times with a couple of our guests before. But he is here to tell us about artist management and how he got into it.
Yeah, it was so great to finally chat to James and meet the man behind the mystery. And we hope that you enjoy this episode. Take it away.
Hello, this is James Black. I run James Black Management and I work for singers in opera and concert.
Before you embark into your current role as an agent and artist manager, you have had a thriving operatic career beforehand as a countertenor. Could you please share with us what that time was like for you?
Well, I don't know that it was thriving. I made a living. That is something.
I mean, in these days, that's thriving.
And to some extent, although I'd always sung, you know, I was sent away to choir school when I was nine. And that was because, you know, I was always singing the things my father was playing, and they just thought I had an ear and I'd been put to the piano. But I don't think I ever quite intended to become a singer. I did read music at some university, but only because my father wouldn't let me read English. He said, if you read English, you'll become an English teacher. And I thought, well, I'd love to be an English teacher. It was my favourite subject at school. So I ended up reading music. And then when I left Oxford, my father was very insistent that I did a PGCE. He said, you know, you need a good qualification. And so I then went to the other place. I went back to Cambridge, where I'd been a chorister, and I did do a PGCE, but I did English as my second subject. So that was, at least was something. And while I was at Cambridge, I sang in the chapel choir. And I also, as a result of a drunken bet, actually, went and sang to a marvelous man called Tim Brown, who was running the Cambridge University Consort of Voices. I never thought I'd get in. And I did. And we did a lot of work. We did the Sainsbury's choir competition, I remember, up at Buxton. He gave me my first paid solo engagement, the alto solo, all one line of it, in the Monteverdi Vespers in St. Mary's Church. I think I was paid £25. I thought I was in heaven. And so I thought, you know, maybe there was something to this singing malarkey. And also while I was at Cambridge, I'd been singing down at St. Albans Abbey at weekends because it was quite an easy train route. And I can't quite remember how I got to be at St. Albans, but that had started as well. So I was singing a bit more and I got myself a job as an English teacher, I'm glad to say. But before that term started, I did a summer course at Dowie Abbey, and there was a wonderful American soprano called Judith Nelson who was teaching the course. She's no longer with us, but in the 70s and 80s, she did a lot of recordings for L'Oiseau Lear and the Academy of Ancient Music, singing duets with Emma Kirkby and so on. And she seemed to like what I did. And I remember she had me singing an aria from Giulio Cesare. And then she said, I want you to do this at the end of term and week, you know, concert. And I'd like you to do it with some Baroque movement. And because I'd been a junior associate at the Royal Ballet School before I went to choir school, I wasn't afraid of movement. So I was sent into the French dance classes and I quite liked it. And so we devised this choreography that I did for this Giulio Cesare aria. It was the Sei in Fiori, the one man in a brat. And I thought, you know what? I think I'd like to give this a bit more of a go. And I got back from the course and I explained this to my recently widowed mother, who was not remotely impressed, who, of course, you know, she thought I was going off to earn a sensible living as an English teacher. But I took my courage in both hands and I wrote to the school and said, I know I'm meant to be starting in 3 weeks' time, but I cannot with all sincerity commit to this. And I'm not going to be joining you. They were quite good about it. They said, well, if you really don't want to do it, there's no point coming. And I had a deal made that I would work in the local bookshop for a year and I would have regular singing lessons. And if I got into music college, we would take it from there. And if I didn't, I was to get a teaching job. And I mean, it sounds bonkers, but this is all absolutely true. a few weeks later at St. Albans for the Saturday afternoon service, there had been a lot of Purcell. I don't know why it wasn't even Purcell year, but there had been a lot, you know, Canticles by Purcell, Anthem by Purcell. So there was a lot of countertenor soloist, and it was my week to be doing the solos. And to earn some extra money, I was also working as the choir librarian, which meant collecting the music and putting it away after services. So after this sort of James Jamboree, as it turned out, I was in the stalls collecting music, and I was approached by a gentleman who said, "I really enjoyed your singing today. Are you doing anything more with it?" I said, "Well, I am hoping to get to the Royal College of Music for next year. That's my ambition for this year." He said, "Well, why don't you come this year?" I said, "Because the auditions were last December and term starts on Monday and it's too late for this year." And he said, "My name is Jasper Thoroughgood. I am the registrar at the Royal College of Music. And I think we could find a place for you."
Wow.
Which is absolutely true.
No way.
That is incredible. So, that is like every young singer's dream, though.
Well, like, just it was a bit of a shock, though, because I was thrown into a conservatoire scenario without really the training behind me to make the most of it, because I was going in as a postgrad, not as an undergrad. So there was a lot of learning on my feet. Yeah, I was very lucky. I got funding, which pacified my mother. I got some money from the college, which I then put towards having piano as a second study, because I'd always played the piano, and I thought it was useful to keep that going. And as a result of a lunch in St. Albans, I got my first manager, because he was at the table, and he'd been singing, and he was going to be starting up as a manager. He said, "Would you come and sing to me?" So I went and sang to him and said, "Okay, I'll put you on the books." And so I became a young music maker, and the agency was called Music Makers. And there were four of us, Deborah York, me, Robbie Johnston, and Lawrence Wallinghead, I think it was, Whitehead, Wallingham, not the one who's at Westminster Abbey anyway. And a weekend after weekend, there we were in drafty cathedrals, singing Messiah and the St. Matthew Passion, learning our craft.
That's incredible.
And I was still at the RCM. But when I left the RCM, I think, you know, because I had a manager, I'd done a lot of concert work. I hadn't done any real stage work. And it had all happened so quickly. And I think I said, my mother had been widowed during my postgraduate year. And she had gone to live in Lincoln. And the organist from St. Albans had moved to Lincoln. And I felt that I just needed some time to consolidate. I didn't feel quite ready to get into the singing malarkey. So I went up to Lincoln and sang as a lay clerk for 18 months, living in the Cathedral Close, which is lovely. And I continued doing concerts. And I felt I needed to do more with it, I guess. So I was earning enough to get a mortgage in London. In fact, I bought my first flat in Clapham. Wow. And I moved to London, and I was doing a combination of some teaching of English and singing. And it sort of grew. And I suddenly got to the point where I felt I really want to do this more. And I did some writing around, and I was invited to audition at the Theater Magdeburg in the former East Germany. For the role of Oberon in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which was certainly not a role I'd ever anticipated singing. But I went out and I got the job. And so I began to do more opera from that. And I had some lovely times. I did two seasons in Magdeburg. I did Berterido and the Rodelinda in Passau, which was a very unhappy experience. And I loved the team. I just hated the role so much. That was the beginning of the end for me. I did Nereno in Francisco Negrin's beautiful production of Giulio Cesare for the Royal Danish Opera, and then at St. Tolomeo when it went to Bergen. I created the Caterpillar in Alexander Kneifel's Alice in Wonderland at the Netherlands Opera. extraordinary songs, which I can't repeat on that. So, you know, I had some good things. I did my concert work as well. Didn't do so much stage work in the UK. But I think also because I'd started singing a bit later, I'd always sort of had a slight cut-off point in my head, particularly being a countertenor. I didn't sort of really want to be an old countertenor, if that makes any sense. I think yes. it is a voice for youth. So I'd always had this cut-off point in my head. And then in my last year singing, I did five operas back-to-back, which is basically called going bonkers. got into, I'll be honest now, into some technical issues. Because I was tired. I remember doing a recital with Helen York for the Limbury at Covent Garden. And I said, I can't do this. And she said, there's nothing wrong with your voice. You're just so tired. And so I stopped in rather a hurry, in fact. In fact, I was on contract at Covent Garden covering in Orlando when I made the decision to stop. And it wasn't working. The teacher I'd worked with for quite a long time had stopped teaching, so that didn't help. And I did go and see somebody for consultation who said, you know, I've seen you in performance at Sadler's Wells now. You've got into some bad vocal habits, mainly to do with the way you're using the breath. If you take 6 months off, I can get you back. And I thought, you know, I'm 38. I didn't really want to take 6 months off. And will I get back in if I do that? And so with some trepidation, I just decided that I was going to stop. And I applied for two teaching jobs, English teaching jobs, obviously. One at a state school in High Wycombe and one at a private school in Surbiton. Got them both and decided to go to Surbiton.
And there we go.
So there I was, you know, teaching English, heaven.
What you originally wanted to do, what your dad really didn't want you to do.
Yeah. But I only did it for 18 months because you're asking how did that then get into management. Well, one of the things that had happened while I was singing, that everybody has downtime, and I had done some work for one of the London agents who didn't have a concert office, but knew that this was a really important thing to have for singers, because not everybody wants to be on stage all the time, different people have different talents. And they were honest enough to appreciate that they didn't quite know the repertoire in the way that they did the operatic repertoire. So I came in essentially to run their concert list. And I found that I really enjoyed it. You know, here's a budget, you know, balancing a team for Messiah. So when I took the teaching job and I stopped singing, I thought, you know what, I'll keep my hand in. And I started with a list of eight singers. It was basically people I'd worked with. You know, and I thought I'll do Messiahs and Matthew Fashion. I wasn't going to sing in them, but no, I was going to organize them. It sort of grew, and by the summer of 25, I'd stopped singing in October 23, started teaching January 24. It sort of had got to the point where my other half said, you know, you've got to make a decision, because you're coming home after teaching and you're working till 11 o'clock on Matters Agency. You're in a situation where in your free time at school, you're not in the staff room drinking bad coffee, you know, you're in your room trying to catch up with your marking and on the phone to, you know, the Opera House or this concert society. And Peter Catton at the Opera House isn't going to be impressed if the only time he can get hold of you there are small children yelling in the background. And the headmaster's not going to be impressed if he comes in and you're engaged on school premises in non-school activity. So I took a deep breath, literally. And I used my teaching salary to get a mortgage down in Rye in East Sussex, which is where we had always wanted to live. My uncle was still living and working in London, and moved to Rye in December 25, secure in the knowledge that if I did not make a success of James Black Management, I'd not be able to pay my mortgage. And that is quite motivating.
And now in your work as a manager, would you say that the work you did as an opera singer affects your approach in your work as a manager?
I think they are rather different skill sets. I think one of the things that having been a singer helps with is that I have some understanding of repertoire, not just my own repertoire, but, you know, I was interested in the art form itself. So, and I think I have a love for the art form that has endured. And I think that maybe helps you to find positivity with things, whether other people might be looking at numbers, I don't know. I think also, having been a singer, I can sometimes understand the singer mentality. And, you know, even if it's something very simple, like being wrong at 7:45 in the morning and being, you know, a good lad, I'm ready for work, even if I haven't had a cup of tea, and somebody is saying, oh, I've just tried warming up and my voice feels terrible, I can't do my audition this evening, I'd say, well, actually, it is 7:45. Your voice is unlikely to be at its peak at this point. Can I suggest you let me have a cup of tea and you have a cup of tea, and we'll speak at 10:30 and make a decision then? And then it's often, oh, I'm absolutely fine, I can't think what I was thinking. Because you've pulled a few stunts in your time, you recognise them when they're happening. That's a slightly glib example. But you know, sometimes within the rehearsal process, if it's, you know, proving a tough process, you've been there and you can help somebody rationalise why a situation might be as it is and stop them from perhaps saying something to the director that they shouldn't do, because it will damage their relationship with the company. They can talk it with you, or I can talk it out, to have that sort of understanding. I can remember once explaining to the Paris Opera why my artist was not going to sing an orchestral rehearsal of Siegfried on a Monday morning at 10:30, because they would have sung a matinee of Valkyrie the day before. It was a complicated scenario where the singer had gone in on a double casting and ended up doing all the performances. And the lady at the Paris Opera is saying, but it is a matinee of Valkyrie, what is the issue? I said, okay, it's starting at 4 and coming down at 11, rather than starting at 6 and coming down at midnight. But 12 hours is not enough between finishing Valkyrie and singing the Siegfried Brunhilde, which is a higher tessitura, with orchestra, yeah, because you have to sing orchestral rehearsals. That's an unwritten law in the theatre. I said, so it's just not practicable. And I think because I had been a singer, I could understand that and portray my singer's position with conviction. It can also mean that knowing the rep, I had an example that came up only on Saturday, and had an artist who had come in from Paris who wasn't feeling great then, sang a rehearsal on Friday and explained to the conductor there, and then, look, this is not going to work. They were high mezzo doing L'Enfance du Christ of Berlioz. And I didn't have a high mezzo available, so I suggested to the conductor, can you try some of my colleagues? They may have some ideas and I'll try as well. And none of this was getting anywhere. And then, because I was interested in the music, not just the business, I recalled that Elsie Morrison, who was a high soprano, had recorded Mary in L'Enfance du Christ with Colin Davis in 1962 for the Oiseau Lyre. And it occurred to me that maybe the right sort of soprano might be able to rescue the day. And by 10:45, I had found the right sort of soprano, and by 2:00, they were rehearsing Mary in L'Enfance du Christ. I gather it went very well. But again, that was thinking outside the box.
Yeah. That is very interesting, though, because it's things that you don't think about. Like, the usually when you talk to singers, it's like people in the industry don't necessarily know the industry in the sense of, like, they don't know repertoire. But it's not only knowing repertoire. What you're talking about here is also knowing vocal fatigue and vocal awareness, knowing that, like, you can't do a Valkyrie one day and then a Gute Dameron rehearsal the next day. Like, that's just not going to happen. And it's things that you also, as a singer, like, we as singers need to think about, like, when we're looking at our schedules, we just can't keep going all the time. We have to be very specific about what we want.
I mean, sometimes the best thing a singer can do is not sing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But sometimes the singers don't necessarily see that. You can get in your head about it and you need a manager to say, this is what's going on. Deep breath.
Yeah, but you lose the freshness. I can remember one thing I used to quite enjoy. If I'd done a big project, say like this Alexander Kneifel, Alice, which was a crazy thing, went from bass bottom A to soprano high C. It wasn't written for me, but I was the person who created it. I think I'm the only person who's ever sung it, because the person for whom it was written decided it was unsingable. Then the person who replaced them decided it was unsingable. And I got a call to say that Martin Bravins, who I'd jumped in for some schnitka with at about 3 days' notice, had this stirring of memory of some countertenor with a freak range who might be able to do it. So I went and sang it to Martin in London. I'd come back from Magdeburg, in fact, and in those days we had fax machines. I am that old. my housemate said, I don't know what this music is, but I feel ill looking at it. And I think it was in Russian, and my Russian was very limited. Now, I'd been in Magdeburg, which is the Old East. I could say, hello, goodbye, my name is, but that was about it. But I went and did the session with Martin, and I was then going off on holiday for 2 weeks to South Africa. And I took the music with me in my bag to the airport just to see what was going to happen. And I kid you not, I was rung at the airport by my then very fine manager, Neil Dalrymple at Music International, to say, I hope you've got the music with you because you're doing it. So I spent quite a lot of that holiday learning this piece. I think I had 6 weeks to learn it.
I would have been flipping out seeing that come through the fax machine. Also because the fax machine was quite slow printing. So it was like the doom scroll.
Yeah, I also, slowly. And because it was to curl up as well. And because I'd been doing Oberon, because it was already beginning to curl up.
You're just rolling it out. Oh no.
It didn't really help when he got the printed score. I mean, it was the most bizarre and extraordinary thing. I mean, Chris Gillett said it looked like the Cirque du Soleil on crack. And you'd be there. And it was in the Carré in Amsterdam, and we had this high, raised set. And I can remember sitting on the edge of this, towards the top of it, chanting nonsense Russian syllables with Roddy Williams, while Yvette Bonner, as Alice, at the other side, had a pair of scissors, was going, and up through the stage floor came Harry van der Kamp as the lion, as in Lion and the Unicorn. And a boy from the Tolks choir came up with this spike on his head, and he was the unicorn. And you could see the audience with their jaws completely dropped, thinking, what the hell is this? That was a great experience, just as it was, you know, the first night of the Giulio Cesare in Copenhagen, this beautiful Francisco Negrin production. And we did it uncut, just about, I think one B in Dal Capo was cut in the Sesto aria. So we were starting at 7 and coming down at 5 to midnight. It was just extraordinary, but it also taught me something about my own singing career, because I was singing Nirena, and it's quite a small part, although I was on stage throughout. You know, I opened the show and I closed the show. I was there the whole blooming time. And you'd be coming in to do your little bit, having a lovely time on stage, and there would be the crowds waiting for Andreas Scholl, who was singing Cesare, you know, with their CDs and their LPs and their photos. And he used to come in at the half. He just had basic stage makeup and put his military fatigues on. But I thought, how do you cope with that level of expectation from an audience, you know, who traveled miles to see you? And he was a lovely man, you know, very relaxed within himself and confident of what he could do. And again, very clear about what he could and wouldn't do stage-wise. But I thought, I personally couldn't do that. I would not have wanted to be asked to sustain that sort of career. And that's also quite useful as a manager, realizing from your own experience that there are different levels of career which have their own justification and validity, rather than everybody's got to be the person who they're queuing at the stage door to see.
Absolutely.
I think everybody needs to be reminded that there are different kinds of careers, and you can still be successful even if no one's queuing for you outside the stage door.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, think of all those wonderful people who make careers singing. There's no such thing as a small role, but you know, the confidants and the maids and the armed men. I mean, I look after a wonderful lady, Sarah Pring, who sings, you know, a lot of that sort of role. She did sing bigger roles when she was starting out, but she feels much happier now. She likes being on stage, but also by her own performances, she enhances what the principal does. So if you see her as Anina, for example, in La Traviata, in the last act, and Anoush, of course, sang Violetta with her at Covent Garden with Sarah as Anina. And you know Violetta is sick, not just from Anoush's acting or Anoush's makeup, but from the way in which Sarah Pring as Anina treats her, the way she responds to Dr. Grenville, who, you know, Violetta is saying, oh, last night I slept much better. And Sarah's behind her saying, doctor, she really didn't. You know, and it makes that character come alive. Got a very good young bass baritone, the Carter, who's at E&O at the moment. And again, fantastic direction, showed again that there's no such thing as a small character, only singing Sharone in Tosca. And you recall in Act Two, there's the torture scene and it takes place off stage. And Tosca says, I want to see him. And Scarlett says, he's fainted. Sharone, stop. And Charone comes and says, tutto, tutto. And normally Charone comes out, tutto, tutto. Charone came out retching at what he'd seen. So this small character actually made you realize that what was going on in that room wasn't just any yelling off stage, that it was a torture scene. So every character can inform a performance and be important. Mm-hmm. I believe that really strongly, because it's working for a bigger good. And I think that's one thing, going back to my early days doing a lot of choral society work, also informs the way I look at things. Because if you've got a choral society, your fees are being paid out of their T's and their subscriptions and their tombolas. They've been learning this music for an entire term. They've got more to sing than you have, and they know it really well. And you have to turn up, you know, on the day, rehearsal, just one rehearsal, and do it. But it isn't about you. You are the professional icing on their cake, because this whole thing is something much more important than you are. It's Bach's St. Matthew Passion, not James Hugh Jeffries as countertenor soloist.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That, again, informs the way in which I think about performance, in the way I think about management, who's going to be the right person for this.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Because it's taking away the fact that it's about you. Because when you perform, it's not about you. And no, we had this conversation with many other people on this podcast. You're feeding someone else's emotional state at that moment. It's about tapping into that audience member or coming together as a group. And even though you might have like small, silly things that you're doing, it doesn't mean that you're not important to the story or important to that person's experience.
Exactly. I still remember seeing Grace Bumby at a masterclass, Cicada Singer of the World. And I was in huge veneration. She'd been the first Tosca I'd ever seen at Covent Garden in 1973. I remember being very cross as a little boy that I couldn't see her jump because we were too high up in the theatre. It was on the side. But I was, you know, allowed to queue at stage show and see her afterwards. And there was this, you know, tall, glamorous lady in this mink coat. It was very special. And she signed my programme and I still got it. But she was working with a singer with a fine voice, but shall we say, a less well-developed artistic sensibilità. And she stopped and she said, stop there. I can't understand a word you are singing. If you do not sing the words, you fail the poet who wrote that text. You fail the composer who chose to set those words to music. And most of all, you fail them. Never forget that without our audience, we are nothing.
What's the first step to getting, as a young singer or as a director, a conductor, what are the first steps in order to get an agent? And how do you know when it's the right time to get an agent or manager?
Again, my personal experience doesn't help much here, because I was at lunch after morning service and was just invited to go and sing to somebody. And then when I switched agents, I was doing an audition for the Royal Opera at the Shaftesbury Theatre. You know, the Opera House was closed. And I was waiting in the wings to go on. And I was just told by Kate Sackville-West, who was then running them, O'Neill Dalrymple's come in to hear your audition. I thought, oh, no extra pressure here then. I had tea with Neil. And the next thing I knew, I was at an audition. And then someone said, oh, I gather you're with Neil Dalrymple. It was news to me. I hadn't been told that it was, but there was his name against mine. So that my experience, as in everything you've heard about my life and career, has been completely non-standard. I think you need an agent when the career inquiries that are being made upon you are beginning to move out of your own ability to deal with them. Otherwise, why would you pay somebody to sort it out for you? If you're beginning to get clashes with diary inquiries and you don't know how to deal with it, maybe you've won a competition and suddenly the industry is after you. Because, of course, now that you've won the competition, you're singing well, not the fact that you were singing well in order to win the competition. And you may need somebody to help you there. It can be that you're with one manager and it's not working and you need a fresh approach. Now, I've had to say to people sometimes, don't think this is working, and they flourish like they feed in the proverbial wilderness with somebody else. Or somebody has come to me having got stuck and I managed to find a new way forward for them. So it's an intangible, really. But it's also that you need to be ready for the opportunities that a manager is going to throw at you. If somebody comes to me, they can bet their bottom dollar that within a few weeks, they're likely to be being put across the desks of good people, both here and ideally in Europe. And if one of those companies turns around and says, for example, the Royal Opera, this person looks really interesting. Can we hear them in 6 weeks' time? That you don't throw up your hands in horror and say, oh my goodness, I couldn't possibly sing for the Royal Opera. Because if you couldn't sing for the Royal Opera, why are you wanting a manager? It's having a realistic sense of what you can do.
Do you have that conversation with a singer when they come to you, when they approach you? Do you have a conversation with them about...
Yeah, I will say, what do you want me to do? Get me work. Yeah, what work? Where do you want to work? How can I help you get there? Oh, I think, I don't know if I could do that. And again, this is another wonderful quote, probably slightly embellished by me because I use a lot of words and she doesn't, from Baroness Bull, to do with the anticipation and of nerves. That bad nerves only kick in when your perception of the task to be achieved exceeds your own perception of your ability to achieve it.
I need to think about that for a second.
Yeah, just process.
So you need, can you say that again? Just my brain went.
Bad nerves only kick in when your perception of the task to be achieved exceeds your own perception of your ability to achieve it.
It's like when you oversell yourself and you're not sure you have the right product at the end.
That you can't do it, exactly. So Peter Cat would like to hear at the Royal Opera House, oh my goodness, I've got to audition at the office, I can't do that. Those are bad nerves. If Peter's asking to hear you, there's a likelihood that you've reached a stage where you're interesting. Yet it's a challenge. I look after somebody who sang a lot of Brunhildes, and somebody said to her, isn't singing Brunhilde really hard? And she said, no, it's challenging. She said, it challenges me to the utmost, but if it was too hard, I wouldn't be able to do it.
That's also very true. I think a lot of us confuse the meaning of hard and challenging. Like, not everything has to be hard, but a lot of things can be challenging.
And challenges are there to be overcome, so.
And sometimes you face the challenge and you think, you know what? This is too much for me. I hated singing Bertarido in the Rodelinda. I did 10 performances of it. I could sing it if I was absolutely fit, but if I wasn't absolutely on form, and how often are we absolutely on form? Not very often, and usually on a day when we don't need to sing in the shower. It challenged me not just to the maximum of what I was capable, but in some instances, in terms of stamina, took me beyond what I was comfortable doing. It chipped away at my own confidence as a singer because I always found it really hard. It didn't get easier. It was always really hard. And I think it was also because I hated the character. I mean, he's such a wimp. If you sound like Andreas Scholl, that's fine. People will sit there and listen to you for hours on end singing, Doris, Conrad, come on, Marie, Kitty Boy, save you. I wouldn't want to listen to me for hours singing that. God, I was much happier doing the Caterpillar or Nireno or Rinaldo. I love singing Rinaldo because he had some energy.
Yes.
Bertarini moped all the time. And I'm not a moper by nature. And I didn't feel that I had the sort of beautiful sound that was needed. Though bizarrely, I'd gone for Anulfo, which is the smaller part, who's the page writer. I really, really wanted to sing Anulfo because he had three really perky eyes. I thought, this is really suits me. Now, I'm not very tall. And I was doing some coaching with the late Ludmilla Andrew, and she said, I think you should go for both. Okay, well, every cantatenor knows Dove stays. That wasn't too hard. I was told by the German agent involved to prepare it in German. So I relearned Dove Se and the rest in German, and I learned my Onulfo aria in German. And I went over, in fact, it was to Landshut, the auditions were in Landshut, and introduced myself. My German was quite good, I'd done it at school. And here's my resume, and you prepared your music from Rodelinda. I said, yes, one from each character, and of course in German. Warum auf Deutsch? Why in German? We are not a Landestheater. I thought, gee, thanks, Frau Schaefer, for telling me to prepare it in German. So what do? You go to the canteen, you remind yourself, what Bertolino is like in Italian, and you learn the words for Unulfo in Italian. What can you do? So, you know, an hour later, I was on stage singing Bertolino back in Italian and singing Unulfo in Italian. And apparently I did a high float at the end of the Dorisei, which they really liked. So they cast me as Bertolino because they liked my high float. So I ended up being cast in a role I didn't want to sing because I could float at the top of my voice.
It's just never say never. Never say no.
Never say.
But I mean, also brought back to me by why the lovely Valerie Marson, who I had lessons with, and I think I learned more from anyone else, should, even if you're learning it in another language, learn it in Italian first. So if I had obeyed her mantra and I'd learned an Unulfo in Italian first before learning it in German, then I wouldn't have been sitting in the canteen learning it in Italian from scratch to sing an hour later on stage without a piano. Wow.
Just made me get all hot stressed. And bothered.
Yeah.
But it actually, that makes sense also, because if it was written in Italian, vocally it would be easier to learn in Italian rather than learn the English and then have to like try and figure out how it would all work. But if it...
Exactly. Yeah. No. I got away with it, shall we say, because I got stung or hoisted by my own petards because I ended up having to sing Bertolino.
For the next question, let's hear if your work as an artist manager keeps you on your toes as much as as your time as a singer. What does the day in the life of an artist manager look like? Is it like an office 9 to 5 or is every day different?
It is certainly not a 9 to 5, and it's certainly, in my case, not Monday to Friday. In fact, what I remembered after I read your questions, and I'll send these over to you if I can find them for later, is that some years ago, Kate Flowers, who used to run the co-opera company, asked me to keep a diary of a week. And I kept that for a week. And it was quite, I only found Sunday so far, but the others must be somewhere on the system. And it was interesting to see the very various things you do. Because of course, it's a combination of things. There are planning things that you've written down. I write everything down. I need to do this for this person. If today for Anoush, based in what's going on, I need to, you know, contact this person about that, contact this person about that and that. But then, of course, things are coming in that you weren't anticipating that you need to deal with. Or, as on Saturday morning, there can be an emergency to deal with. So it's a never-ending process. You know, there's always another idea you have. Oh, so-and-so's just got that. They should be done. Oh, so-and-so's working with that person. I wonder if they know about this. You know, it's absolutely not 9 to 5 in my experience. I mean, it's usually more like 8 to 6 as a minimum, certainly Monday to Friday. And then whatever needs to be done at the weekend. And that can be something just as tedious as balancing the accounts after Sunday lunch. It needs to be done, because if you don't do it, it'll just get left till the end of the year, and then you'll be in tears for days trying to match things up.
No one wants to do the accounts.
Needs to be done. Of course, we're beginning to travel again now. I've not done anything European since COVID, apart from one trip to Vienna, for reasons that I won't bore you with. But I am due to be starting again from January, and that's going to be a whole new ball game. Just getting the stamina to travel again, because I think one of the things I have found, I think colleagues have found the same, is particularly this first season back after COVID, and it has been very full on. Now, I'm glad to say that my accountant said you must be very pleased in one way, because your VAT quarter is now back to what it was pre-COVID. So, you know, my business is back where it was, which is great, but we're not match fit. You know, we're also 2.5 years older than when the pandemic hit, and we had 18 months where we weren't needing to deal with this on a daily basis. Although I will hold up my hands and say that during the pandemic, I was not one of those people who shut up shop and said, that's it. And I had colleagues who were saying, oh, it's awful, what can we do? And I said, look, if it's hard in this industry when the going is good, now the going is terrible, we're going to have to work a lot harder.
Yeah.
And so I worked throughout the pandemic. I had artists who worked throughout the pandemic, who were very lucky because of their particular skill set. One was a BBC New Generation artist, so they spent the year in the studio. Another, we had worked him to the top of the Baroque list as the next tenor to ask. And of course, everybody went Baroque in lockdown because it was small scale.
Yeah.
And Jorge worked non-stop throughout lockdown, including traveling you know, to Europe and back. He said he felt really guilty during lockdown because everybody else was saying, I've got no work. And he was saying, I've never been busier. Now, I was at a recital only last week, and I had sent some material to this organisation, Offrarara, you know, they deal with bel canto pieces. I have a tenor who's ideal for that. And I had sent over a CD to them saying, I know you've got nothing planned at the moment. Nobody's got anything planned. What you have got is time to listen to new materials, because you can't tell me you haven't got time to listen because you're not doing anything. And they were booked for a concert and a recording. They were doing a recital for them last week. And that is something that genuinely would not have happened if I'd not thrown it out during lockdown rather than sitting on in the garden drinking tea saying, isn't it terrible?
Yeah, yeah.
You had to keep going, because that way you couldn't control the pandemic, but you could find a way of not being at the mercy of it. You know, I did some interviews such as this for people. I wrote for Opera magazine. I wrote for Opera Now. You know, I kept my brand name out there. Yeah. And thereby I kept my artists' names out there.
Well, that's also something really important to say. It's like, if you as the manager say, I'm gonna hang up my pen for right now, I'm gonna turn my phone off, that means that your entire artist base is not gonna have work. It's not about you having a hard time now, and it's once again this icing on the cake. It's making sure that everyone else has work, and you're gonna have to put yourself forward and think outside the box. But at the end of the day, it comes back around and you've put the work in, and there you go.
Yeah, one thing I did as soon as the pandemic hit, you know, there was that first week. I mean, I had two artists singing recitals on the 16th of March, lunchtime recitals, one at the Wigmore, one at the Royal Opera House, and both houses closed that evening. That was the first day. And I was already back in Rye. I'd been in London. I was eventually having a long weekend, culminating in going only to one of the recitals. I don't have Hermione's time changer, so I can't go to two lunchtime recitals at the same time. But I just knew that if I got stuck in London, I'd not be able to get home. So I had come home. And of course, all through that week, the dominoes fell. And so from the following Monday, which is, we went officially into lockdown, I think the 23rd, every Monday, I wrote to my artists to give them, you know, maybe an angle, what industry soundings I had, to see how they were, to let them know they weren't being abandoned by me, that as artists, they were all in it together. And now I'm stuck with it. If they don't get a Monday missive, I've got somebody saying, why haven't you written to us yet? But it's fine. I like doing it. I don't just write about music. I might write about dance. I might write about a play. I might write about a concert. I mean, this week, I wrote about the Rye Bonfire, because we had Rye Bonfire this weekend. And it's not Guy Fawkes. Guy Fawkes has got into it, but it goes back beyond Guy Fawkes, and it goes back to invasions, because we used to be on the sea here.
Yeah.
And there's a torchlit procession, and it's quite Wicker Man, you know, painted faces. And the culmination is the dragon, which is like the Danish longboat,
mm-hmm,
that is pulled through the streets. Then we have the bonfire. And it was the first time it had taken place since 2019. And of course, everybody from the town and people come, and you're all there with this shared experience. You know, you're literally, you know, it's like being an audience in a theatre. You're here. And it's that shared experience that is something bigger than just your own experience of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I tied this into citing the Grace Bunbury quote that I gave you. That's probably what was in my head. You know, never forget that without your audience, you are nothing.
Yeah.
The audience has to be, so it's trying to open things up to get people to think outside their own personal box. And you know, even during lockdown, encouraging people, yes, it's dispiriting with everything cancelled, but if you are a painter, do you paint because you have an exhibition coming up? If you are a writer, do you write because you have a publication date? No, you do it because you're a painter. Therefore, if you are a singer, don't stop singing, don't stop working on your craft just because you haven't got a contract to go to. And use this time, because we never have time.
Yeah.
You know, you're always dashing from singing lesson to coaching to concert to whatever. You actually had time to work on your voice, to learn the roles you had always wanted to learn, to listen to that piece you'd always wanted to explore to see, was there something in it for you? Or to listen to something, you know, that wasn't singing. No, I learned about legato, not from singers. I used to squeeze my legato out like toothpaste. I learned about legato watching the Borodin Quartet playing inevitably the Borodin Second Quartet at Snake Maltings. You know, that da 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 da, and it goes round and round and the air doesn't stop, you're going, squeezing it out. You know, you can always learn from something.
Yeah.
So, you know, use this time. And you know, I hope that writing to them was a help, that it did make them feel that they were not alone. You can ask Anusha for lunch.
Yes, I will do.
I put it straight in my trash can.
So, in addition to working as a manager, you also do a lot of work with young artists all over the world in places like the UK, Vienna, Rome, and my country, Israel.
Yeah, well, of course, a lot of that has been stopped by COVID. But, you know, I certainly did, I think, three sessions for Michael at the Maitha studio.
Yeah.
And two sessions for Eleonora in the Roma. Vienna was a great thing. That was actually the summer of 2020. It was the one trip I've made abroad since lockdown. And I was, coerced is a slightly strong word, but not overly, by the two people who run the Vienna Opera Festival, who said that we really would love you to be here. And I had the most fantastic time. I really, really enjoyed it.
So my question is then, when you work with young artists, what is it that you want them to accomplish from working with you? And what is it that you look for in young artists?
I want them to learn to tell the story. I want them to learn to think independently about a character and how they could realistically present it. What makes a character tick? What has the composer told you? What is in the score? A couple of examples. In 2020, when I was working in Vienna, I'd done 2019, which was their first year, and that was quite stationary. But 2020, they were doing Don Giovanni, and it was a good year, and I found two wonderful singers who I'm now working for, which I'll help answer the second part of your question. But what was most useful was trying to get people to look at the words and listen to the music. There was a really interesting Spanish soprano who was working on Donna Anna. And you know, Don Giovanni, Don Ottavio says, so tell me about that night. And she doesn't say, oh, it was like this. The music goes, what am I going to tell him here? And so she's obviously hiding something. The music tells you that. And then she says, a man came into my room who I thought was you, because we all know that Don Ottavio comes up the drainpipe wearing a mask. We know he does that. Of course he does. You know, that's his and Anna's things. And she knows she's locked herself in it. And she says, Garrido, I screamed. And what does the orchestra do? But no one came. And I said to Estefania, so why did nobody come? And she said, because she didn't scream. This is all a fabrication that Anna is creating for Ottavio. I said, well, I said, I'd never thought of it like that. I know this is a work I love. And she said, well, if you look at the Act One trio, when Donna Anna comes on and she's pursuing Don Giovanni, she's singing Gente Servi Aita. It's all marked pianissimo. So she's doing what she thinks is the right thing, but she doesn't want them to come and stop this because she's enjoying this.
Yeah.
And then she said, and you know, we never understand why, I had never understood why, in Non Mi Dir we have that cabaletta, the and she's saying, maybe God will have pity on me, not forgive my father or bring us together. She said, maybe one day God will have pity on me. And Stefani said, well, it's obviously because she knows that she's guilty or complicit in her father's death because she didn't shout loudly enough. And the commendatore comes and gets killed by Giovanni. And this, she's beating herself. It's Catholic guilt. And suddenly things began to make sense. And this is somebody looking at what the music and the text was telling you, not this is how Joan Sutherland sang it.
Yeah. This is also looking past just your aria that you're bringing into an audition or into a coaching.
Oh, yeah.
Like the fact that that aria is just a snapshot of that character, you need to know the buildup. And
yeah,
But it's also an opportunity to put your own stamp on it as well.
You need to know where it's come from and where it's going. I remember hearing a soprano in an audition singing Manon, Adieu notre petite table. And I had a great friend of mine who'd been a wonderful Manon sitting with me. We got to the end, and Sally said, just allow me, I've done this role. This is act two. You don't die until act five. What is the marking in the score here? And this soprano looked at her. Said, it's marked, I think, no, simply, or without affectation or something. She said, it's a very young girl at the first crisis in her life. And what does she say goodbye to? A table. She's the ultimate material girl. And at the end, she ends on a major key. Here comes the next stage of my life.
Yeah.
That you can't just get into this wallowing. Or I remember, this was Valerie working with a Susanna on Di Vieni. And she said, has Susanna ever been tempted by the Count? And this young soprano said, of course not. And Valerie said, of course, yes. She has seen the silk. She's seen the chocolates. She's seen the champagne. She'd love a bit of that. She's not going to go for it. But there's a bit of her that knows that it would be lovely to have that. And that's why she can sing Di Vieni as a love song to Figaro, but he thinks it's sung to the Count. And if you don't get that ambivalence within it, you make Figaro look stupid, and he's not a stupid character. And if you make him look stupid, you take an edge off his character.
Yeah.
It's back around to that idea of it all coming together as one unit.
So, you know, that's really how I work. Mm-hmm. If I'm working with singers, if I'm doing a, I used to do classes at the Royal Northern. I used to love that before lockdown. I've got a Zoom one later this month, and I'm hoping to start visiting again. And I think people will always astonish me, what do you look for in a singer? Storytelling. Well, don't you want them to have this qualification or that qualification? I said, musicianship certainly helps. But in terms of what I find interesting in a singer, it's this response to the text and the response to the music. Mm-hmm. That's what really fires me up. And those are the people I like to work with and to manage. Of course, that sort of singing isn't for everyone. Some people may want something that's louder or bigger or higher. And fine, there are managements that deal with that fantastically well.
Yeah.
But for me, this is the way I like to work. And I think it's true to say that most of the singers on my list work within those parameters. I mean, I remember conductor David Chernak once saying that he thought there was actually a James Black sort of singer. If you looked at my list, a lot of these singers had quite similar qualities. They didn't sound the same, but their approaches.
A lot of very theatrical singers on your roster. I just saw Ross Remgloben in La Boheme, and I texted him afterwards saying, I loved how you took the stage. Like, you just lit up the stage. And that's, once again, one of those smaller characters, quote unquote. But without him, there would have been a missing depth to La Boheme, because he just took the stage to another level.
He inhabits the character. And also in the last act, that just that facial interaction he has with Musetta, I think it was Daniele Danese.
Yeah.
The way they looked at each other, they knew it was hopeless.
Yeah.
But they're putting on a face.
And they're still going to buy her a month, even though it's...
Yeah. It's going to be the last thing she gets. And it really is going to be 2 minutes worth of muff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a beautiful moment in that production, which I noticed the second time I saw it, that after Schaunard says, Marcello Sfirata, she's dead. And he's got the candle lit to warm the medicine. And he just snuffed out the candle.
It was brilliant production.
I've taken so much from this podcast. It's fantastic. But just to round things off, can you share any advice for emergent artists that are looking at starting out?
Be strong. You need a lot of courage. Be prepared. Know your score, not just your aria. Be ready to go, because opportunities, when they arrive, can be short-lived, but also very quickly presented. I think that's really important at the moment. know your voice, have your technique secure enough to not entirely forget about technique, but to get beyond technique and remember why you are doing this. If you're doing it because you want to be famous or a global star, I reckon you're in the wrong industry. I think you need to do it because you like taking in air and emitting it as expressive sound and communicating with people.
That's a quote for the quote board.
Yeah, absolutely.
Singing should be a more beautiful way of talking. And if you wouldn't say it in a particular way, why would you sing it that way?
You've given me so much to think about. So please tell us, is there any place that people can follow your work online and get in touch if they have any questions, if you're up for answering them?
Always happy to answer questions. I think if you're in this industry, we have a responsibility to help people. You know, I've got X years of experience as a singer, X years as a manager, longer years as somebody just immersed in the art form. So if I can answer, I can. Although often I do find that the older I get, as I am no longer young enough to know everything, I tend to ask more questions than I give answers, but always happy to help. I have a website, jamesblackmanagement.com. There's a JBM Facebook page, which lists performances, reviews. There's always Artist of the Day, which is a JBM artist being featured. So you can get to know my list and actually see them or hear them performing something. And there's a Twitter account. I don't do Instagram. I'm too old.
That's totally fine. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with us. This has been absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's been amazing to chat. Well,
I hope it's been helpful, and it's been very nice to see you both and to share some ideas.
This week's question we thought would be appropriate to ask, what would you ask an agent or a manager if you had one, or if you were in the market for one?
Yeah, I feel this question comes up quite a lot, but it's not, again, spoken about. So here we are with questions and answers on AA Opera. You've come to the right place. But I would be asking, what do you need from me? That's what I would be asking, because I think that initial step in getting an agent or a manager is a little blurry. And I hope that in the episode that you've just listened to, that has been answered. But I would ask a specific manager or agent, what would you need from me? Is it voice reels, recordings? Is it CV? Like, at what level do we need to be? What do we have to have in order to be prepared to put ourselves forward to managers and agents?
That's a good point. I would want to know what they envision for my future.
Yes. And making sure that, like, the agent you're about looking to work with is a good match for you, like, believes in you.
Yeah. I want to know what roles they want to do with me, what their intention for my career. Do they want me to be busy, quote unquote, or rather that I do small roles? But, like, what is the end goal? I think I need to know that we're all on the same page. Like, my goal would be to do X, Y, and Z, and that their goal is X, Y, and Z as well.
I think that's the important thing that I think James...
And that they would fight for me in a room.
Exactly. And I think James mentions this in the podcast, but to go forward and be clear on what your vision is for what you want for your career in opera. And that has to be a match. It's like dating.
Yeah. It is dating. Dating. Ugh. There's so many other ways in life that we have to, quote unquote, date, in addition to just actually finding your, like, life partner.
Yeah.
And it's so aggravating because you don't think about it until you get to the point where you're like, I'm tired. I'm meeting all these new people, but I'm not getting anything out of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's the way up between the term dating versus networking. I think they're one of the same.
I don't see the difference between dating and networking at the end of the day.
Exactly.
Except of like what the outcome is. But like in the same idea, like even with dating, there's a lot of energy that goes into it. You have to look presentable. You have to like know what you want type thing. If I don't know. Dating and networking are exactly the same thing, and you should just be thinking about it in the same exact mindset.
Yeah, agreed.
Need a lot of energy for both of them.
Thank you so much for tuning in to yet another episode of AA Opera Podcast, and a big thank you to James for joining us for the interview.
Yes, thank you very much, James. And if you would like to follow us along, we will be back obviously next week with another episode. But you can also follow us on Instagram, and you could support us and become our subscriber,
indeed,
and member on Anchor or Spotify.
Indeed. And if you really love the podcast, then please make sure you give us a lovely shiny 5-star rating, and make sure that you are clicking that subscribe button and following along. We'd love to hear from you. So head over to the social media and get involved.
And lastly, if you think we're really thirsty, you can always buy us a coffee over on our link, which is in our description of the podcast, or on our bio link on Instagram. But for now, we will see you next week.
See you guys. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.